Where to now? Okay, people have asked, well, how many satellites are there out there? This is part of our phase two work I can go into. This is our prediction for the civilian, which includes commercial and civilian government-sponsored satellite market through to about 2001. ASG has spent a lot of time on trying to find out exactly who's out there. And based on what I've seen throughout the world at the moment, I'm convinced that we have the finest database of who's there than any organisation in the world. The estimates that you see there are worldwide spacecraft numbers through to 2001. There are two estimates there, high and low. Basically, think of it in terms of optimistic and pessimistic. There are some other implications in that, but I can't go into that at the moment. And basically, you see the market's pretty flat. There's probably an average of around about 25 spacecraft to be flown per year through to 2001. We reckon we can make a commercial project out of this if we can capture a quarter of that, and it's part of the process that I talked about earlier on that I can't talk about now, but we think we have identified a way of capturing about a quarter of that market. So you know, that's the core of the fairly constrained optimism that I'm showing at the moment. To emphasise that point I made earlier on, I think this is almost the final slide, where are all of these satellites going? There's some 600 satellites in that previous chart in total. You can see that most of them are going into equatorial type orbits. See the height of that bar there? Same assumptions, optimistic and pessimistic estimates. The spacecraft that are going in the polar orbits, by comparison, is quite low. So what that says is that we are prepared to sacrifice some technical credibility in selecting our site at the expense of polar orbit spacecraft. That is not where the market is. It's in these guys. So any argument about overflying Central Australia or whoever has to be tempered with that type of assumption or information. Well, that brings me to where we are now. Now that brings me to what I'd like to see by about 2010. That's a wonderful artist's concept of the British Aerospace Hotel of aerospace and plane taking off out of Cape York. The only thing I don't like about it is if the runway was really that long, it would be about 120 kilometres long compared to the Cape at that particular point. Slight exaggeration, but it's a fun slide to finish on. Thank you very much. It's purely out of the It's up to the two consortia only, now.
So we don't end up with two facilities.
I think common sense says that that might happen. I'm sorry.
Good question.
I
think there's something that would be a rather important consideration since quite the creation of 35,000 jobs would certainly be quite
factor. No, I think we should avoid that. We've already had that problem. There was a fair amount of PR given by someone else, who I shan't name at this stage, to the fact that in their concept of a spaceport, they were looking at bringing 40,000 people onto Cape York. And that caused so much fuss and proved to be totally unacceptable, both into the current occupants of the Cape, even though there's only about 3,500 of them, but to the whole of New Cook Shire, that caused all sorts of problems. So we don't believe that Cape York should evolve into, say, a city of 10, 20, 30, 40,000 people on it. I don't think it could take it. People are far too sensitive about the area itself, as they ought to be.
Just a question, how long will it take to create the appropriate infrastructure? Three years. And that's for a basic facility
which can launch several classes of and vehicles from it, but is optimised in the first instance for only one. More facts about data in the handout I've got over there.
I presume you're going to keep the office so that you get a high payload
for the vehicle.
Now the ever-powered payload feasibility. And the economic feasibility. What projections have been made about the improvements in the fuel?
Yep. Well, you can answer this question in two ways. The simple way of answering it is that if you took a rocket that normally flies, say, from Cape Canaveral, flew from Cape York instead, depending on the particular vehicle, but you're talking about something like 12 to 15% extra payload mass into orbit from Cape York. Now, for the second question,
for these improvements in the fuels, I assume that they are improvements so as to increase the payload. As I understand it, the whole project is critical on the payload and carrying and the short return to the air. Now, are they in the project
Probably not in the expendable and vehicle field, but in the shuttle type and vehicles, yes. You know, we can talk all evening about sort of screen and jets and all this sort of thing, but yes, there are improvements in the offing.
Have you involved in the development of Australian military?
Yes, in Adelaide.
what can you say about the viability and possible characteristics of which?
Bob Irvine, yes, I know them extremely well. Well, they'd be treated simply as a customer. Yeah, I mean, to treat them the same as any other people. They do have a big advantage though, in that their vehicle is all solid propellant, apart from in the upper stage. So potentially they could fly that particular vehicle from a very simple site. And perhaps if we concentrate on their own vehicle, and we haven't so far, they could fly not 3 years after go ahead, but perhaps in 1.5 or even 1. Is that answering the question, or because I found it a hard question to sort of understand the thrust of it.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to see what you say.
I'm aware of them, yes. In fact, when their proposal first came up, I helped them on some of their attitude and control and subsystem sort of questions. So I'll say there's been helping that consortium for quite some time now.
From political stability, is there any other comparative advantage that we have over the existing French or SAR? And what about transport costs and transport issues and getting satellites and vehicles here?
Transport is something that people tend to get fixed about. I'll answer that question by pointing out a couple of facts that of existing facilities. Again, take the French down in Kourou. Every satellite customer that they have to ship their spacecraft from either Europe or the States, or in two instances, Canada. Now, even though it's no further, or it isn't as far, sorry, to go to either of those places than to come to Australia, having been through the heartache and the agony of doing it, I suspect it would be much, much, much easier to ship to Australia than to French Guiana. I'm absolutely certain of that. I don't have any figures in front of me, I don't know. And the second example I'll quote is that the OSSAT spacecraft, the two that we were flying in 1991 and 2, they will fly from China. So far, we have had much less hassle in organising that shipment. Alright, it hasn't happened yet, but you know, even taking a similar point in time, organising that shipment than organising our NK3 satellite one. So I don't think shipping is a problem. And the actual cost of shipping is a very small component in our overall picture. Very small component.
Can you give us any segment of the commercial picture, or the present-day launch charges of Cape Canaveral or something?
Yeah, well, it's a hard question to answer, but I think I can. It's hard because so far the prices charged have not been based on any commercial common sense. Because they, as I said, well, in the case of Cape Canaveral, all the sites are owned by the Air Force. And up until one launch ago, the only way a commercial user could access those tags was as a subcontract to the US Air Force from NASA. Now, when you've got one government organisation subbing from a second, the overhead structure is just phenomenal. Okay, now, having preambled it, the answer is that we believe that in something like a Titan 3, and I haven't explained a Titan 3, but that's a very large vehicle, the US Air Force probably charges something like $5 million US for its services per launch. Now that tapers down to something like a Titan, a Delta, for example, which is about a third the size of a Titan III. And the charges in that instance are of the order of about $1.5 million per launch. But it's impossible to extract the exact figures.
Given that the formation of Delta and the WhatsApp has done a little bit toward reversing the brain drain within years of time, which is leading to trade. We talked around a little bit about the number of staff and what computers may be employed, but what about engineering wise, during the development stage and operational stage of the launch?
Yep. In the construction phase, you're primarily talking civil engineering type folks, and we're looking at a total staff, this is only engineers, of the order of 300 to 400. Now, just off the top of my head, I would think about a third to a quarter of those would be engineering staff. Now, the operational phase, on the other hand, we're talking about a total on-site permanent staff of the order of 150 to 200 people. Now, I would think that about half of those would be engineering types.
Assuming that both groups come up with a yes on the, on the feasibility studies, what then? Who decides how it goes from there?
And capitalism strikes again. The free market. Whoever has the most attractive proposal, he'll have all the customers. Simple as that.
What role does our ubiquitous Australian Space Office have in all of this studies, and is it likely to play a role through the development of aerospace, the space policy for Australia in the future?
The answer is yes and yes, in whatever form the Space Office is in after the, in about 6 months' time. I'm sure you understand the implication in that comment. But to expand on that answer, the Australian government has to be involved in this, if only because under various treaties, international treaties, Australia's a signatory to it, any space object launched from Australia incurs certain obligations on Australia. So they have to be in there as part of it. And the Space Office has been extremely helpful, to us at least. Extremely helpful. Yeah.
Does the viability depend on any concessions from the government? Are they being... Is that necessary for the viability of the project?
If what you mean concessions are
important
things that the government has to do that aren't available to other companies, in anything like a similar situation, the answer is no. But it is definitely true that in the concept that we have come up with, the government has to be on side, federal government, I mean, well, in particular federal government, and they have to support one particular strategy, and they have indicated that they are fully behind that strategy already. But it's not a subsidy or a support, it's an assistance. It's in kind, not in cash.
I'm showing that chart you showed year by year launches, whether that included use of reusable launch vehicles.
That includes satellites, independent of what they fly on.
Right, so what percentage were...
Well, you have to understand that there is only one reusable vehicle that's likely to be available in that time frame. That's the current space shuttle. You also have to understand that the space shuttle is now and likely forever going to be unable to offer commercial services. President Reagan issued an edict throwing all commercial spacecraft off the shuttle manifest, and it is not likely that there will be any space on the shuttle or any commercial spacecraft for the, well, personally I think, until the end of the current shuttle and program. So I don't see that as a question or as an issue.
Right, so well, it mentioned that it cost about $300 million to establish first thing. How much extra would you have to put in there to be able to cater for that sort of
Not a lot. What we've identified so far is taking as an example hotel, that thing. We've identified that in order to accommodate hotel above and beyond what we plan on installing already, we'd have to extend the Air Force runway by, I forget the figure, I think it's about a kilometre. Hotel needs about 3.7 kilometres. I think they're planning about 2.5. We have to increase the cryogenic storage capability, hydrogen and oxygen, I mean. Probably have to provide a fairly sizable hangar. So, you know, that's not incredibly expensive stuff. All right. It would probably put that price up by 10-20%, something like that.
The market for whole civilian application?
Yes. I haven't emphasised that, but we are not looking at military satellites at all, because that takes us into an area that we simply aren't prepared to treat, to be perfectly frank about it. There's someone up here had their hand up. Yes,
well, Mike, you indicated the advantage of the near equatorial launch site. What is the disadvantage of going further north, going to an area around Bangkok?
Can't do it. I won't show that slide. If you go too far north, the southern tip of PNG starts intruding into your flight corridor about 1500 kilometres downrange. Okay, so that's a fairly simple answer to that one. See how it sort of comes down here and sort of intrudes.
What's that? Of course, we have a very strong commitment for this project, from a communications point of view, which is what ground satellites and others. But at this stage, Bond Corporation have similar requirements because they're interested in communication. BHP are also getting involved in communication. Where do you see the real commitment from, let's say, others than OSCAP to this project?
Do you mean other consortium partners?
Yes.
Comalco and Martin, for example.
Comalco,
it's easy. They are the current occupiers of that land.
Yes.
And they are after alternative applications of the infrastructure that they've set up. So they're extremely supportive. You know, it's not healthy having company towns. You know, that's a bad environment for anybody, what do you think? So if they can sort of attract other organisations into that community, they're all in favour of it. Now, as far as and Martins are concerned, and the other partner who we haven't sort of touched on, they are the suppliers of the Titan vehicle, and they're stuck with a situation at the moment where in the States they only have one commercial Titan pad available to them for equatorial flights, and that is a pad that can be preempted at any time by the Air Force. And because of that, they're actively seeking alternatives throughout the world, and they have their finger in all sorts of other spaceport studies as well. So that's their interest to, you know, they have a corporate policy now to expand into the commercial spacecraft market.
What are their advantages
of horizontal platforms? Well, I'm not an expert on this, but I believe the advantages of air-breathing horizontal takeoff is that you don't have to carry into orbit a sizable fraction of oxygen to air-breathe. Okay, so it's a substantial saving there. And say HOTOL, for example, how they plan, not operating, is the engines of that. Their primary fuel is hydrogen, but and they burn that with oxygen for thrust, but in the atmospheric flight phase, it's atmospheric oxygen. It's only when it's out of the sensible atmosphere they switch to oxygen stored on board. Now, you can only take great effect of that if the major part of your flight is in the atmosphere itself. Okay? Hence, the first advantage is an horizontal takeoff. The other advantage is that it's inherently a much safer way of accelerating. You know, shuttles and things, the head sort of straight up, they have to turn around and come home again. Ever tried an upside down turn at Mark 8? It's terrific. Whereas if you're flying, you know, essentially as an ordinary aircraft, then you have to and come home again in some fashion or other, it's comparatively straightforward. Now, bad or pluses, I mean, one of the problems in any high-speed atmospheric or essentially atmospheric craft is external heating, of course. So these horizontal takeoff craft, the heating problem in ascent is almost as serious as in a descent. And in the case of the engines, it's a higher problem.
actually, Nathan? You know what that is.
Quite science isn't not my field.
It certainly isn't mine. Okay.
What comes to the list of the logic content?
Yeah.
How much the coverage includes in the
video? Well, yeah. I shouldn't show that slide. It gets people as worried as hell. The width of the corridor you have to allow either side of your nominal flight path depends on the vehicle itself, intimately on it, and in particular if it does break up in flight into what size pieces, you know, how do they fall down, all this sort of stuff. And there's a whole science in that, analysing all of this. But we have found, for example, that in all of our sums so far, or in all of our trade-offs so far, we've got a very, very fine database from the Challenger accident, for example, that we've taken that as our worst case. But you can't imagine a more widespread situation than that. I mean, it got torn apart 72 seconds after launch. It was going at Mach 8 at 42,000 feet. All the stuff landed up to 200 kilometres offshore. It was just scattered all over the place. So in all of our work so far, we have basically assumed a Challenger accident at any point along the flight path.